Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, soft socialism. And Richard, we taped this episode in the wake of a report released by President's Council of Economic Advisers just a few days ago, purporting to show the perils of socialism and using that as a cautionary note about the agenda of progressives who are actually increasingly comfortable using that particular S word. Democratic socialism, you know, has now become the way in which many of these candidates refer to themselves. So why don't we start at the definitional level, because the right has tended in recent years to use socialism as kind of a catch-all epithet for anything that it regards as insufficiently free market. But how would you define socialism?
Well, I mean, there's a number of disputes about this, but the strongest and most sensible of the definition is one which talks about socialism as the collective ownership of the means of production, where the means of production in question include not only the manufacture of stuff, but the financing of that. So the government owns the factories and the banks and the distributional chains. And the only private property that you have within the system is consumer property. It's an open question under socialism, for example, as to whether or not people can own their own homes or lease them, or whether these things are to be provided by the state through some system of subsidized housing. But even if you put that aside, it's a massive form of government control. The issue which is sometimes related to socialism but distinguished from it is the question of whether or not you could have a strong welfare state which gives things like guaranteed income. And the difference between that and socialism, at least in the strong sense, is the way in which you fund these programs is through a system of high taxes, sometimes flat, usually progressive, and then you take the money and you give it to individuals. And it need not be socialism, because what they could do, for example, is in the Canadian system, is they can take the money and go to private physicians or other people who are in the practice of medicine, or they can go and they can buy goods in various kinds of markets. So they have the money, but it's a separation of the wealth transfer from the operation. If you want a convenient illustration of that, when Milton Friedman put forward the system of let's have vouchers for education, he wanted to have public financing and private provision. The public financing was designed to make sure that poverty was not an incurable obstacle, and the private operation was to make sure that there would be a competitive economy. The difficulty that you get into this is if the services become too rich and the taxes become too high and the conditions attached to the way in which you can spend your money become too great, the two things can slide one into another. But the usual comment that people on the right make, which I think is correct, is you don't want to talk about Sweden and Denmark as Norway as socialist countries, given the fact that they have these large safety nets, because they are, in fact, working in a foreign trade environment with most of what they make, and they have strong private property institutions. They've actually cut their tax burdens a bit, and in fact, they have the private ownership of the means of production. So that's what the kind of definitional struggle turns out to be, and I think it's important to keep socialism on the extreme side. Now, one more problem with this is exactly what does it mean to talk about government ownership? And there's no question that ownership can be divided in many different ways. So if you have a regulated industry like a telephone company or an electric company, which has its fees set at the maximum level by the government, is that a form of socialism given the price control? The customary answer to that is no, to the extent that you're trying to regulate a monopoly, and it's a little bit less clear when you're trying to regulate a competitive industry, because at that point, the reduction in rates and the increase in costs can bankrupt the firm, after which the government will take it over. So you can see how it is that these things get muddy. So that's the sort of the basic landscape. And there's no question, if you look at some of the things that I cited in my column, many of the people who were talking about democratic socialism were talking about an end to capitalism, by which they meant an end to the private ownership of the means of production.
The point that you made a moment ago is one that you will hear certain progressives make. They'll say, you know, you conservatives start going on and on about socialism and you invoke people like Mao and Stalin and Pol Pot and Lenin. But in reality, what progressives want isn't that radical. It isn't inhuman. It isn't authoritarian. It is, as you mentioned a moment ago, it's basically modern Scandinavia. They'll argue, you know, everybody's pretty happy there. And yeah, the government has a much more expansive safety net and people don't have to worry about their basic needs. But this is not the kind of radical totalitarian system that you folks are invoking. Richard, if we take them at their word on that, are those Scandinavian countries and the kinds of systems they have worth emulating for America? Are they possible to recreate in America?
We'll start with the second question first. These are small countries, relatively homogenous in terms of their ethnic situation, pretty much a common language, a common tradition. The United States is, you know, 25 or 50 times the size of some of these countries. It turns out it's a much more heterogeneous population. When you want to put these socialist institutions into place, they have to be superimposed upon institutions that are already there. So, for example, if you look at some of the proposals for changing medical care, what they want to do is abolish the private practice of medicine and have everybody start working for the government. They want to get rid of all the private insurance companies. That kind of a transformative situation cannot take place in the United States without the most awful dislocations that you can imagine, and nobody has figured out how it is that you're going to work those kinds of transitions. The second point is, we're not talking, if you're talking the redistribution stuff, about socialism. The much better comparison would be the labor governments in England, where there really was nationalization of major public facilities, railroads, electric power companies, coal mines, or whatever it is, and that system essentially cratered. Because it turned out that once you had this Labour Party in charge of one government, you could never close down any form of inefficient facilities. You could never inspire anybody to invest in new industries and so forth. So what happens is, by Margaret Thatcher, the famous line was, socialism ends when people run out of other people's money. And that was exactly the risk. It was a serious dislocation. I was involved in the liberalization of New Zealand back in the 90s and the early part of 2000. And when I went there in 1990 with a very strong Labour Party government, with export subsidies on the one hand and tariff imports on the other and various kinds of heavy regulation, strong unionization, this country was on its last legs. And my job, which we actually accomplished, was to persuade people to liberalize labor markets. And the situation was roughly as follows. In 1990, it was about a 57% union situation. Every single measure of human welfare, wages, life expectancy, whatever it is, they were all trending downward. We got something through known as the Employee Contracts Act, which essentially made it much more difficult for unions to maintain themselves. The unions went down in numbers from about 57% of the economy. A couple years later, it was down to 20%. There were 600,000 new jobs that were created by the removal of some of these kinds of difficulties. And the position in New Zealand as of 1995 relative to 1990 was a transformation. By 2000, the socialists take over again, or the Labour Party. They have a Employment Relations Act, which is non-contractual. They could never bring it back to the other situation, but things started to sputter. So it turns out that the problem that the progressives have to face is they do not accept the standard economic theorem that competitive markets outperform all others, so that regulation should be done with an eye to making sure that monopolies do not get created, or to regulate their return if you could figure out how to do it. What they want to do is to upset competitive markets. And it's just a matter of a first and most fundamental economic theorem that if that's what you're going to do, you're going to increase costs, you're going to reduce output, and you're going to create political friction. There is no way around that, because the economics are so clear. And in fact, the progressives are often quite schizophrenic. Oftentimes, they want a really strong enforcement of the antitrust laws in ways that are actually anti-competitive. But to the extent that they understand the importance of competition in product markets, it should warn them against regulation everywhere else.
The assertion that you hear from certain people on the hard left these days, and I guess more accurately, the slogan that you will see on the placards, is that capitalism has failed, or capitalism is failing. Now, I don't – to try and get inside that thought, I don't think those people are asserting that it hasn't thrown off the kind of wealth it has. But I presume that the argument would go something like, yes, it throws off all this wealth, but it overwhelmingly accrues to the people who control capital. This is the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and you're just exploiting the guy who is out in a field, you know, working for 8 hours, gets a pittance, and the guy that he works for captures all the profit. How do you respond to those kinds of complaints, Richard?
Well, the biggest response to it is it's just plain false. I mean, you could read this in a whole number of places. Johann Norborg wrote a very fine book called Progress, talking about the change in all the vital indicators, both worldwide and in the United States. It turns out, strangely enough, on Vox, a liberal site, they had one wonderful column said, 10 particular ways in which the world has improved that you might not have paid attention to. And if you start looking around, the most salient indicator in all of these cases is what happens to life expectancy. And until the last 2 years, where the downturn has been driven by opioids and similar problems, this was a uniform upward trend. It was most powerful during the period of maximum laissez-faire capitalism in the United States between about 1870 and 1940, where life expectancy goes from roughly 40 to 65. Or 65 in the space of essentially 70 years. And there's no way that the top 1% can accrue all of those benefits. So the first thing you have to do is to ask the question, do you look at this stuff solely in terms of wages, or do you look at it in terms of a market basket of good which has wages and all sorts of private and personal amenities? And if you look at that last number, essentially the morbidity and mortality figures tell such a different story. Because what happens is a rising tide raises all ships. And if you were to start looking in that period at the correlation between labor productivity on the one hand and wages on the other, it's extremely tight, because what happens in a competitive market is you're always willing to pay somebody more money if it's going to make you richer. If you look at a monopolistic market with labor unions, you resent paying more money because it's going to make you poorer. And so in the one case, you get industrial strife, and in the other case, you get a sort of high level of cooperation. And so no matter where you want to look, medical process, accident rates, automobile rates, and so forth, things are better. Even to put it in another way, if you take the period from, say, 1993 to the present, which is 25 years, and run these same measures, things like medical adverse events are down by 70 to 80%. Pipeline leaks by the dreaded oil companies are down by the same number. Automobile fatalities are down by the same kind of rate. So what's happened in the United States is if you take not the income figures but the amenity figures, the very things they're stressing, those things have made people much better off than they've ever been before. Now, why is it? Well, for several reasons. One is technology constantly drives prices down. So computers, which would have been a luxury item in 1993, everybody's got four of them in a family. TVs, electronics, and all the rest of that stuff. The second thing is the rich are the only people who can afford to fund public goods, disease control, safe pipelines, police and security, and all that. And as these things get funded, everybody else gets the benefit. So the crime rates have gone down by over 50% in the same time. None of this, as far as I can tell, can be attributed to the system of redistribution. What really drives the economy is innovation by new people. And so when the socialists start talking about how they're going to take over the means of production, it basically condemns you to a world in which the kinds of activities that you had going on at the date of the takeover are the ones you're going to have 10 years. Nobody can explain how it is you're going to get a Google or an Amazon or an Apple coming out of a socialist system, particularly if the moment it gets large enough to earn some real money, somebody's going to be able to expropriate that. And this dynamic element of growth, which is so critical to any kind of an economy, is something which the socialists cannot manage. Even large firms find it extremely difficult to do growth work. They become stable consumer companies. It's the new guys on the block that come in. And when people start saying, well, the rich, you know, they have all the money, these are not the same people in 1993 that they are today. People come and people go from this classification. So that, you know, the Rockefellers, which had an enormous amount of money, what do they do today? They become fairly genteel and they run foundations, but there's not a one of them whose income puts them in the top 500 in the United States. Most of the real money in the United States in the billions is made by the people who have it, and most of that's been done in the last 20 years or 25 years.
In the piece that you wrote for Defining Ideas, there are two big practical problems that you highlight for socialism. One is the incentives that are in place for producers when you have a system of collective ownership. And the other, drawing on Hayek, is the problem of knowledge. Give us the Reader's Digest version of those two difficulties.
Well, the point about incentives is really very simple. Everybody agrees that all sorts of non-pecuniary elements matter in the way in which you run things. But if, in fact, you give somebody all these wonderful side benefits and tell them that they put in huge amounts of work and their capital return is going to be X as opposed to being unlimited, that is going to necessarily depress the kind of effort that they'll put in. And so that you won't get these people maxing out on their credit cards, working incredible hours in order to do this stuff, because the benefit is going to be expropriated by somebody else. And what you really want to do is give them a free run, let them earn their billions. The basic rule of thumb in this business is if I create a business that's just going to produce $100 billion of consumer surplus net benefit, I'm going to get 10% of it. So I'm a $10 billion guy. But $90 billion of that is going to go to people and you don't even know who they are. Some are going to be employees. Some are going to be suppliers. Some are going to be customers. Some is going to be the public at large. And it's a great deal to have essentially that 9-to-1 leverage kind of feature. Besides, one of the happy things is Bob Barrow pointed out many, many years ago, nobody knows how to consume $1 billion. So you end up creating foundations. You create the Sloan Federal Foundation. You create Stanford University. You create Johns Hopkins University. You create Carnegie Mellon University. Who are these people? These are the billionaires that you're talking about who unload their dough because it's the only sensible thing that they can do with their money. So the earnings don't give you the information about distribution. The distributional patterns are not necessarily egalitarian, but they certainly are radically different from the earning tank. So that's the first point. On the second point, the problem about knowledge, somebody has to figure out what they're going to put into place and they're going to make. And we have two processes that you could think about in the simplest and pure form. In a market situation, what happens is somebody offers me a good for $10. And I ask myself, is it worth more than $10? If so, I'll buy it. If not, I won't. Now, I'm not asking this other guy, now, why is it you're charging me $10? Maybe it should have been $8. Or maybe it should have been $12, God forbid. I don't go into the cost of production. I just do it. So essentially, he gives me a finished bundled product and takes care of the cost himself. And then he doesn't ask me, well, why are you willing to spend $10 on this thing to figure out whether or not my benefit is going to exceed $10? So the system essentially has the price mechanism to coordinate information. And that was Hayek's great insight in this wonderful essay that I recommend to everybody at any time, which is The Use of Knowledge in Society, that came out in the 1945 American Economic Review, which talks about this coordination function. So what happens is when you run this through the administrative state, you go through these things and somebody's going to say, well, you want to produce this. What are your costs of production? You want to consume this. What are going to be the benefits that you get? Now, in monopoly cases, we're willing in some circumstances to run through the analysis of how much does it take to produce electricity. But that's a huge fixed plant with relatively constant technology. You start doing that for computers, and you have no idea what the cost is going to be in 3 years, knowing what you know to the cost today. And so since you can't do this stuff, you don't know how to set the rates. And then if you set the rates, the rigidities are such you never know when and how to change them. One of the reasons why labor unions have suffered precipitously is they basically have a system under law which says that if the firm wishes to change the labor agreement, unless it's previously provided for in the collective bargaining agreement, it has to secure the consent of the union in order to do so. That's a bilateral monopoly problem. It takes forever to negotiate these things, and by the time they're negotiated, the opportunities are gone. And so what happens is price flexibility means that you incorporate the knowledge, and every time you do this, you think of the following thing. If I raise my price, I'm going to get more revenue from the customers who buy, but I may have fewer customers. Does it make sense for me to do this? And if you're trying to maximize your own revenue against people who are trying to maximize their own consumption benefit, it turns out you don't get a perfect equilibrium, but you do a hell of a lot better than you do under the administrative state. And so it's the question of administered prices, which is the heart and soul of socialism, always is outperformed by market prices, both in the initial setting and even more importantly, with respect to the subsequent modifications.
So the final question that I'll put to you, Richard, let's assume for a moment that it's 2021 and we've got a new progressive president and a new progressive Congress, and in one of the great legislative triumphs of all time, they steamroll through the entire Democratic socialist agenda. So we're talking free college, single-payer health care, what they would call Medicare for all, a federal jobs guarantee, $15 an hour minimum wage. What does that world look like? What are the implications? What happens in a country where all those things are suddenly a reality?
What happens is it instantly implodes. One of the reasons why the stock market is down is because of some of the silliness with Donald Trump and international free trade and things of that sort. But part of it is an estimation that come 2018, 2019, 2021, there'll either be part or total progressive control. But if you actually look through the Sanders program and the Warren program and put it into place, the stock market goes down $5,000 within the first week, if it's actually going to really happen. Because everybody knows that the taxes will become prohibitive. Everybody's going to try to get out of risk investment. A new investment will start to dry up. The burdens will become crazy. The way in which you handle this stuff is by two methods, both of which are politically explosive. One is you have people stand on queues, and the other is you cheapen the currency by printing all sorts of dollars. That program in that form, even if you think it's peaceful, it will take you about a year or two to make us start looking more like Venezuela than we do today. I mean, what is so extraordinary about people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren is how little they know about the simple fundamentals of supply and demand. If they only drew those curves and then started to see what happened when you put the subsidies and the restraints in, they would start to realize that the further you deviate from that market equilibrium where price and quantity are equilibrated, so you have the same amount of goods wanted and sold as are bought, the greater the disaster and the social losses. They don't seem to understand that. And this is because essentially they're doing political work. They're not doing economic work. And one of the things that the president's economic report was trying to do was to explain what the economic consequences should have been. Perhaps they should have gone softer on the discussions of Venezuela and Cuba and so forth, but perhaps not. Remember, Cuba was a vibrant economy when I was a boy growing up. If you remember Guys and Dolls, where did they go for their great vacation? They went to Cuba. Venezuela was perhaps one of the richest countries in South America 25 years ago. People were scrounging on the streets. Everybody says, we won't go that far. But they never tell you where it is that they're prepared to stop. And the real danger is somebody like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, as best I can tell, have zero knowledge about the uses and limits of market behaviors. And their kind of economic ignorance translates into political poison.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.